Blowing on us. Blowing on us.
Friends, we are picking up once again after a break. I was in Israel for 2 weeks, and all is pretty well. There are always a lot of things. It's a lot worse. The political situation is always a lot worse when you're here than when you're there. When you're there, most of the time you think about living, and the living is pretty good. And when you come back here, you're not living there. You're thinking about the issues, the extent that there are issues. If any of you are interested in more detail, I said a little bit about it last Shabbat. The radio program this week, I just talk about the trip, essentially. The radio program this week will be just about the trip. Usually I have a guest, but whenever I go on these trips, I end up without guests, so you end up getting me. So I talk about the trip for the hour, or for most of the hour anyway. This is on Sirius Radio. Sirius Radio. A man of many subscriptions. Unfortunately, this system here, I think, is really continues to be a detriment, and I wish we could figure out how to shut it off. Because the noise, I don't have the feeling it warms anything up.
It's blowing cold.
No, yeah.
Cold from the window.
Cold from the windows. Maybe we can shut it down because it's.
Someone listens to you.
It's a pen in the neck. What?
Someone listens to you.
Good. Very good. Now, what I would like to do today is to once again skip. I'm interested in getting through this chapter and in exposing you to the varieties of material that are in this fourth chapter of Bava Metzia. So I'd like you to turn to page 58b, 58b1. And I want to start with the discussion of the end of the Mishnah, 58b1.
Block,
You're on block 58B.
First, second page, okay.
58B.
The
Mishnah? This is Nun Chet Amud Bet, before the Mishnah. Tanya, this is about 5 lines down on the page. Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Afa Mocher Sefer Torah Ein La Ona'a. Okay, Nun Chet Amud Bet, beginning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down the last word on that line. Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Now, what this is referring to was the very end of the Mishnah. I remember this Mishnah that we were studying was that while we had learned about Ona'ah, general concept of Ona'ah, we found in this Mishnah that there were a variety of things that were exempt from Ona'ah. Among them, the principal ones were land, for example. Land was exempt from Ona'ah. And then we saw some other things like slaves and hektesh, things owned by the temple. Okay, that's what we had discussed before. And we slowly began to further sophisticate the idea of what Ona'ah is, Also, when we talked about seeds, you remember a little bit about seeds. When you throw seeds in the ground, and you there's the question of whether there's ona'ah concerning these seeds. And then the Gemara asked, well, what do you mean by that? Is that like if you're supposed to throw six seeds in the ground, six bushels, and you throw only five bushels in the ground? Then the Gemara says, no, that's not it at all, because if you do that, that's called fraud. Okay. That's really fraud. And ona'ah is not fraud. Ona'ah is something different. So I want you to see that, because the notion of ona'ah is, on the one hand, and in certain contexts, one would think that it is fraud. And yet you see, in fact, as the Gemara kind of works it out, it's really not fraud. It's rather when you do something and you don't have the intention of defrauding anybody, but there is something about the transaction that turns out to be unjust. Okay? So that was in general. Then at the end of that Mishnah, there was a minority point of view of Rabbi Yehuda. And that's what's brought here at the end on 58b. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Afam ocher sefer Torah margalit ubeema. This also, namely the exemption from ona'ah, applies as well to a person who sells a sefer Torah, a jewel, or an animal. Ein lehem ona'ah. Ona'ah does not apply to those sales. And if you remember, the Mishnah went on a little bit further, and the rabbis rejected that. They rejected it. We didn't know why, but they just rejected it there in the Mishnah. So the Gemara goes on, Tanya. Now here you see it not only in the Mishnah, but as is characteristic of the Gemara, occasionally you'll find a Baraita that contains the material from the Mishnah, and the Baraita amplifies it. So here we have it again, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Afa mocher sefer Torah en la ona'ah. Now in the Baraita, we're going to learn why. Why would the laws of ona'ah not be applicable to a sefer Torah? Lefisha ein ketz ledamea. Because there is no end to its value. All right. Interesting point. But realize, of course, that that's only one kind of ona'ah. Because ona'ah also involves underpay. So, in other words, you can't overpay for a sefer Torah. But in theory, you could therefore underpay, because the very notion here is that it is something of tremendous value. Well, therefore, you shouldn't underpay for it, but you can overpay for it. Okay? Now, of course, this is not the halacha. The halacha does not go according to Rabbi Yehuda. We saw that in the Mishnah. Having said that, it's interesting to see the reasons behind his view of why these things are exempt from ona'ah. Behema u'margalit en lahem ona'ah, an animal or a jewel are exempt from ona'ah, mipnei she'adam rotze lizavgan, because a person wants to match the things that he already has. In other words, an animal, if you're dealing with an ox, a farmer who has an ox wants a pair. For whatever reason, I'm not a farmer who's ever used oxen. But oxen are used in teams. And I do know that an ox team has got to be a well-matched team. You can't just have two oxen and put them together. They will push and pull and defeat the purpose of having the two of them. Okay? So what that means is that a person is willing to pay over the market price for a matching ox. All right? So things like that, people have special needs. And in fact, they're willing and ready to pay beyond the market price. And therefore, he says the laws of ona'ah do not apply. Okay? Same thing is true for a jewel. If you have a jewel, you may want to match it. You have one earring, you want two earrings. Okay? And therefore, to you, this may have a special value. Because to you it has a special value, you're willing to pay more for it. And therefore, it should be exempt from the laws of Onan. Again, I remind you, this is not halacha. But this is Rabbi Yehuda's reasoning. It's not unreasonable reasoning. Okay?
Isn't it? It seems unreasonable.
Well, let's go on a little bit further. Because Amrulo, you'll see why the sages, what the sages say to him. Halo hakol adam rotzeh lezavgan. You could say that about anything. So it's unreasonable. According to the sages, yeah, sure, you maybe you want matching things, but you could say that for nearly anything. And the basic concept here is that some people may want something specially, and therefore, in a way, you could say there is no such thing as a market. Everybody has a personal side to himself. Everybody has a special desire, and the whole concept that there's a market price is perhaps, well, it would be destroyed if we say that everything is unique. So the rabbis totally reject this. They reject the idea. Because in fact, they really believe in and want to establish the validity of the market price in transactions. Okay? Okay, the Gemara, though, comes and defends Rabbi Yehuda. The Rabbi Yehuda, right? How would Rabbi Yehuda respond to the sage's critique of him? Hani chashivilei. He would say that these things, namely an animal and a jewel, are important to a person, and he's willing to overpay for them in order to get a matching. Right? Hani lo chashivi. But other things are not like that. So we don't have to worry that this principle is in fact going to destroy the whole idea of the market. These are odd cases. They're special cases. They are very special cases, and therefore he pointed them out as special cases. Right? And it doesn't generally apply to most things. It only applies to very few things. But because it applies to a few things, where in fact people want a matched pair. And he means that quite specifically. There are a few things where matched pairs are very desirable, and therefore those are unique circumstances. That would be his response. Right, the Gemara goes on and further amplifies the idea of Rabbi Yehuda. But ad kama, how much of an overcharge for these things is not considered price fraud? Amar ameimar ad kadei de mehem. Even here, there may be a certain point beyond which, in fact, it would be a case of ona'a. The area that I skipped in the Gemara, one of the things the Gemara deals with, is that there is a point of view that when we learned in the Mishnah that ein lahem ona'a, these are categories like land has no ona'a, that applies only to the issue of ona'a per se. Ona'a meaning one-sixth. The Gemara raises the possibility of more than one-sixth and less than one-sixth. In a sale of land, for example, if you pay more than one-sixth, is that called ona'a or is that something different from ona'a? And it goes back and forth with that. But there the idea is that at a certain point, one might say that even those things for which there normally is no ona'a, maybe at a certain threshold there is. Right? And the Gemara raises the possibility of maybe 50%, not 1/6, but maybe 50%, maybe 100%. Okay? Now, that's what you're dealing with here. The ad kama. Right? Even if we say there is no ana'a, till what point do we say there is no ana'a as far as these things go? And that is ad kadei de mehem, till double their value, till double their 100%. Right? After you get to 100%, then in fact there is ana'a. Okay? Tanya. Rabbi Yehuda ben Betera omer, Rabbi Yehuda ben Betera says, Afa mocher sus, besayas, Saif v'hatitom b'milchama. Also, when someone sells a horse, a sword, or a shield during wartime, ein lahem ona'ah. They are exempt from the laws of ona'ah. Mipnei sheyesh behem chaye nefesh. Because during war times, these things are so essential to life. So that also is an interesting concept too. There are extreme circumstances where, in fact, the normal protections of the law just may not work. Where there is such tremendous demand for items, such as in wartime, where the laws of ona'ah, in effect, are ineffective. Because there really is no such thing as a market. Wartime introduces, and I've seen that years ago, I remember several different congregants who had been through the Second World War and who made fortunes during World War II. Just in different areas. One man was buying and selling gold. Jewish man had a notion of the nature of the gold market in Europe, European, and managed to get a hold of a tremendous amount of valuable gold. And because certain things during war times became very valuable, people were willing to trade for high amounts, he made a fortune. Had another congregant who had cornered the market in cotton in South America. During war times, the government buys a huge amount of cotton in order to create uniforms for soldiers. In World War II, suddenly, masses of people were conscripted. And he realized that the price of cotton was going to go way up because there simply was going to be an enormous demand for cotton. Now, are those unethical? Well, that's an interesting issue. But wartime does introduce circumstances like that. You can see, therefore, why there is the Tanya, there is a Braita that raises that possibility.
My kingdom for a horse.
My kingdom for a horse, correct. Correct. Exactly.
But it's so interesting that rational societies could come out exactly diametrically opposed, because in wartime is when America imposed laws against price gouging and price controls. And even in the period in the 70s when we had inflation and oil prices, we had price control for oil. Mm-hmm. So our approach is exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. In times of war, that's exactly when we would impose laws against, gouging. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that they would be against that either. I'm not sure they would be against that because it makes very good sense, very logical sense, to try to stabilize a market to the extent that you can. I think they're operating within a reality which is almost an international reality, which is where you can't stabilize a market. Do individuals then have claims against each other? Because the laws of ona'ah are essentially laws where individuals have claims against another individual. Okay? That I think is somewhat different from the laws that are promulgated that will apply to everybody. See the distinction I make?
Doesn't it say, is it referring to in the fact that during war or something, any price up to double the value is not price war?
Well, that's not clear.
And any price
more than that
is. So
correct.
There's
even within that context, I think Bobby is right. It is not clear whether what we read in the previous Braita is also applicable here. It's simply not clear from the text. It could be that that is true. Could be that if you get to that threshold, be it 50%, be it 100%, wherever it is, the law will kick in. Mm-hmm. Now, just a few words of summary. I want you to see this and a little bit of the give and take here, because we're essentially, and we have been essentially since the beginning of the year, dealing with a halachic discussion. It's a discussion of law based on a verse of the Torah. And we've taken it to be a legal discussion. And that's been the way in which it's been worked out. In truth, I must say, it's a little bit different from that. Even the word ona'a, in all truth, I'm still not sure what it means. I'm not sure whether it means some sort of fraud, or whether it clearly is designed to simply stabilize the market. And those are not the same thing. They're different. I simply say that to you because some of the give and take here, where you see that the law appears to go in one direction, appears to go in another direction, and that's frequent in the Gemara, I think part of that in the discussion of ona'a is the result of the fact that the word itself is an indeterminate word. We expect that things will be very clear. That's the sort of general expectation that we have. And that the interpretations of ideas in a religious system will be crystal clear. I think once you get into a legal system, rarely is anything clear. Because lawyers are always trying to interpret texts. And they have to figure out what the standards of interpretation are. And different lawyers, different judges will provide different ways of going about it. And some of the language, like ona'a, we really, truly don't know exactly what it's referring to. Now, I say that to you, and I want to just reflect again on where this all comes from. Let me just see the source again. Hold on one second here. I think it's 25. Okay. The laws of ona'a that we have studied so far come from Leviticus 25. Torah says, in this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his holding. When you sell property to your neighbor, or buy any from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. That's been our verse. Okay? Now, in all truth... What?
Verse number?
This is Leviticus 25. I started with verse 13. Okay? Now, I wanted to start with verse 13 because I wanted you to see the context. Context was the Jubilee year. Remember what the Jubilee year is? The Jubilee year is that every 49 years, the 50th year is a Jubilee year. Land that has been sold during the 49 years has got to be returned during the 50th year to its original owner. That means, therefore, that all land sales are not really sales. They are simply leases. So what appears to be a sale is a lease. Okay? So it then says, in this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his holding. When you sell property to your neighbor, or buy any from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. V'chitin karu mimkar la'amitecha. O kano miyad amitecha. O kano ish et achiv. You shall not wrong one another. In buying from your neighbor, you shall deduct only for the number of years since the Jubilee. And in selling to you, he shall charge you only for the remaining crop years. Right? That's defining the nature of a lease. The more such years, the higher the price you pay. The fewer such years, the lower the price. For what he is selling you is a number of harvests. Now, he's not selling you the land because the land is going to return to him. Do not wrong one another. Again, v'lo tonu ish et amito. You shall not wrong one another. V'yareta melokecha. You shall fear your God. Ki ani Hashem melokechem. For I am the Lord your God. Okay? Now, let me just... I'm reading this to you for a purpose. The purpose is that everything that we have studied so far has nothing to do with this. The whole concept of ona'a that we have been developing is a different concept from what is here. And yet the verse is here. Right? So my point to you is that even in the development of the law, what may have seemed obvious, because we've been so intensely involved with working out what it means when the Mishnah says what it means, in truth, there is either an expansion of the notion that you have here in the Torah, or something else. These verses are used to provide additional ideas, or this is not so much law as ethics. Law and ethics are not the same thing. Something like that is going on. So that what we have taken for granted is the law, I just want you to see it's not obvious that it's the law. It is the law. It becomes the law, but it's not obvious, certainly, from the biblical text. Okay? Yes?
I think that the whole concept of a market price, okay, the act of not doing wrong, is inherent in the concept of a market price.
Say that again?
I said the whole idea of right or wrong,
right or wrong,
the biblical
right
verse, okay, I think that idea of right or wrong is inherent into the concept of a market price.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, I don't see why the concept of ona'a is different, okay, from what the Bible says.
Uh-huh. Anyone want to respond to that before I do?
I would say that the market price should be, it's not right or wrong, it's just a fact, you know, it's just what it's worth to people. It has nothing to do with right or wrong.
Any?
I think what's happening is that the rabbis are trying to codify a notion of not taking advantage of a situation. And what makes it difficult to an economist is that there's always a supply and demand that's shifting. Mm-hmm. But so the prices, you know, to an economist is going to change based upon how much somebody wants something and how many things are around for people to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But there are times like, you know, wartime and other times when what's normally available becomes unavailable and people have it at that moment, like an earthquake in a certain place when you need certain supplies or a snowstorm and you need salt. At that time, things that people have become in short supply and a seller can take advantage of it. So I think, you know, this is what's happening here. You're trying to figure out some way to define when the situation allows, you know, or results in people taking advantage. It's a little like trying to define pornography.
Mm-hmm.
This is like economic
mm-hmm.
pornography.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Interesting. You know it when you see it.
I had a broader question. And I don't have the text from Leviticus in front of me, but it strikes me that you say, more or less, in the context of buying and selling things, you should not wrong your neighbor or one another. From that, one might infer that there are contexts in which it's okay to wrong one another. Or else, why do they have that first clause?
Maybe yes and maybe no. I mean,
huge question.
I'm not sure that one has to go that far. Could be that when we say that you should not wrong one another, that you should not wrong one another. It is discussed in an economic context, there's no doubt about that. And the law seems to be stepping in that context. I don't know that one has to go further than that. You might, but I'm not sure that you have to. It's not a sweeping answer. It's just a prudent answer.
I'm not sure I understand your comment, because isn't it true that for many of the bona fide laws, it's not that clear cut from the text of the Torah, that it's always interpreted sometimes in rather far-fetched.
Yes, I'm not saying that this is totally unique. Not at all. I'm going somewhere with this, and I'm not there yet, because this is leading us to the next Mishnah. But I'll say a few more words in a moment.
Well, one interpretation is once every 50 years you have to treat people honestly, which if we step really cue to the precise context, I personally think it's brilliant. I mean, I think by both saying that the market, in fact, should work and that you have to respect the market, but saying at the same time that there are ethical limits to what you can do within that system, I think that's the perfect balance. I think that's the problem we perpetually face, is the issues of social justice coupled with the benefits that come from having a market.
Very nice, very nice. Then let me take off from there, because I think that you put it very well. It seems to me that what you have in dealing with the law of the Torah, and then what you have in the Mishnah, what you have in the Gemara, begins with a certain indeterminacy, I use the word indeterminacy, of an ethical idea. On the one hand, we know that there is a sense we have of justice, and yet we also know that it's very difficult to apply justice when it comes down to it. Maybe not always difficult, but it's sometimes difficult. We know that there is a changing notion of justice. If we look at any sweep of time, that what the courts or what lawyers will say at one particular point will not necessarily be the same as what was said 50 years before. Now, what do you learn from that? That there is no notion of justice? No, you don't learn that. You learn that there is a certain indeterminacy to ethical ideas, which is different from mathematics. Probably 1 + 1 has always equaled 2. And in science, there is a level of certainty, not necessarily absolute certainty, but there's a level of certainty that is probably greater than in the world of ethics, or than in the world of law. And when we have language that we build ethical concepts on, that language in a way could go anywhere, or it could be itself limited. The Mishnah is a form of limiting that language and of directing that language and of pushing it in a certain direction. So that I think that we will frequently see that the words of the Torah, as you quite correctly said, are interpreted figuratively, not literally, and we come to take that for granted. On the other hand, we can't just interpret them anyway, because if you could interpret everything allegorically, for example, that was the great innovation of Christianity. Christianity said the Torah is true, and we can make it say exactly what we think it says. And the rabbis were not willing to go that far. The rabbis felt that there were limits to the interpretation of the text, and that there was a requirement of continuity. There was not only a written law, but an oral law. Indeterminate theoretical ideas, nonetheless, are fairly specific when it comes to living. And you need a context of specificity. So to some extent, what we've read so far is a context of specificity about Ona'ah. Let's now look at the next Mishnah. Next Mishnah says, Kishem sha'ona'ah b'mekach u'mimin u'mimin kar. Just as there is wronging in... I think he shut it off, didn't he?
He did.
I'm sure he did. You didn't do a good job.
Definitely.
Just as there is wronging in buying, just as there is wronging in buying and selling, kach ona'a bidvarim, so there is wronging with words. Now, listen to that. Okay? We started off with what we thought was a legal discussion, and it was a legal discussion, the whole first part of this chapter. And now, we're taking the same concept of ona'a and applying it much more metaphorically. I'll read it again. Just as there is wronging and buying and selling, namely what we've learned so far, kach ona'a bidvarim, so there is wronging with words. And the Mishnah will give us some examples. Lo yomar lo dechama chefet zeh. One should not say to someone else, how much is this item? In other words, what's the price? You walk into a store and you say, what's the price? V'hu eino rotze likach. And you really have no interest in buying it. It's a fascinating idea. Most of us would never have thought of that. Generally, you go in, you're just kind of shopping.
You're wasting time.
You want to just see what things cost. You're browsing. And you're bothering the storekeeper to take away from a real transaction because you're just having a good time. Right? You're a shopper. It's the shopper's mentality. Apparently, this is prohibited because this is a form of ona'a. This is a form of ona'a.
Rabbi, I'm sorry. Was that verb in Leviticus altanahu? Was that timed?
I didn't hear it. What's that?
Verb tanahu.
Tonu. Lo tonu.
Lo tonu.
Lo tonu.
Yes.
That is where the word ona'a comes from. Yes. It's from there. We'll look at that again in a little bit because the Gemara is going to ask, how do we know this? And then we'll go back to the verses again in the Torah. Okay? It goes on and gives you just a few more examples. Im haya bal tshuva. If somebody was a bal tshuva, they were a penitent. Right? They had become observant. Lo yomar lo zechor ma'asecha harishonim. You shouldn't say to that person, remember what you used to do. Okay, that's an example of ona'a.
So far I'm 2 for 2.
You're 2 for 2. Right? We're not finished. It's really a 3 for 3.
I know, I'm saying, I said there's more.
Im hu ben gerim. If someone descended from proselytes, somebody was a convert to Judaism. You're talking to someone who is a convert. Lo yomar lo zechor ma'ase avotecha. You shouldn't say to a convert, remember what your ancestors used to do. Shene'emar. Shene'emar ve'ger lo toneh ve'lo tilchatzenu. Because the Torah says, you shall not wrong a proselyte nor oppress it. Okay? So, specifically, are you 3 for 3 or
no,
2 for 3? Okay,
good.
Yes.
The difference between 2 and 3 is...
It's just a different example. I don't know that it's qualitatively different. These are different examples of wronging people with words. Wronging people with words. So you see now that the concept of ona'a, which we have as... we've been dealing with as a halachically very specific concept, I'm arguing really is a more indeterminate concept. And it will force itself into certain halachot, particularly in the marketplace. And then it will inevitably, I can't say force itself, but it will be led into, not halachot, but agadot. Agadot. It will lead to certain ethical reflections, which in fact won't be concretized to the extent that these otherwise legal issues of the economy were concretized. Okay? So that's where I was going with this. It was that the general notions of ethical, what's ethical, which is a certain, or what is just, which by its very nature is somewhat indeterminate, will manifest itself ultimately in a certain number of halachot, which are very specific, and as well in agadot, which are really not specific. They become moral maxims, in a way. And I don't think that you can really equate the two. When you're dealing with wronging in the marketplace, you've got laws, and you need to have those laws, and you need to prosecute, and you need to know the parameters and the time frames and all of those things. But once you get to these other things, you may find a little bit of that, but it's much more difficult to do it. Much more difficult to do it. You're dealing with interpersonal relationships and the application of some of these things in everyday life. You can have examples of that. But you will also see in the Gemara that's going to come up, you will also see opposite examples. It's people who will take vastly different points of view. That is the nature of Agadah. And I wanted us to get to this point so that we could begin to also study Agadah. We have been studying exclusively Halacha. Agadah is the lore part of the Talmudic corpus. It continues to be relatively indeterminate rather than specific. It deals with values that are frequently interpersonal, and there are very, very frequently, there is no final rendering, even more so than in the Halachic discussions. Okay?
So I think there are two very different concepts. One is what I'll call taking advantage, and the second being insensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting because the way they give the examples, because the first example is really has an economic dimension to it. Because, as you say, if somebody is engaged with one customer, the next customer, they may lose the customer, you know, who's the real customer. And so there's a real economic dimension to that example. And then we move into ones where there is no obvious economic connection.
Probably right. Although I'd like to add the possibility that maybe the interpretation of the economic side of this is less cogent than perhaps another idea, which is deception. Maybe what we are engaging in here when we're going into the store is in fact deceiving the person we're talking with. And really what we're talking about is that when you engage with another person, you shouldn't engage in deception. And there are certain common deceptions that we use, and this is putting a limit on such deception. So that there's an expansion now of the notion of wrongdoing, which wasn't even really so much wrongdoing when we were looking at ona'a as far as money goes. This, I think, maybe is deception and engaging in some sort of interpersonal deception.
A lot of what we've said before, though, depends upon people knowing what the market is.
Correct.
And one of the ways to know what the market is comparative shopping.
Correct.
Now, if there's really no intention of purchasing, that's somewhere in between.
Right.
But if you had a society where you weren't allowed to ask the price of anything, unless you really wouldn't know what the market is. So
it's also, you're absolutely right. I think it's also a very good literary transition. It's a transition from the discussion of the market to something which is more solely ethical in nature.
I was going to suggest that there's another thing involved, and that is a kind of unequal position in all instances where, for instance, the buyer really is the one that the seller is coming into a shop. It is the buyer who really has the kind of superior position there, the one who can purchase. And if you know something about the convert's background, or if you know something about this other person, there is this kind of inequity a little bit, where someone has a little bit more power. And so there's this idea of taking advantage, either in the marketplace or in knowledge. And I would say, though, in the Middle East, where I've seen a kind of a purchasing that is very different than I'm used to, without, you know, prices being set out and standardized, I think that the seller enjoys the conquest of somebody coming in who maybe doesn't know that they're going to buy, and that seems to be the tradition. So I, you know, I'm not sure that it's such an unequal thing when somebody comes in not wanting to buy there, because that's a place where they convince me when I don't even know I'm going to buy. But it's this kind of not taking advantage of,
I think that's a good way to put it,
a little bit of a different power position, either in terms of knowledge or in terms of economics.
That's a very nice way of seeing what we've read so far and what we're seeing now. Yes.
I have a question about what you're saying about this drawing a distinction between Haggadah and Halakha. Because it seemed to me that you could say that that's a very clear rule. Don't go and waste the shop owner's time. You have no intent. So that seems to me as clear as 1/6. And you know what not to do. Don't go to waste the shop owner's time. Don't bother them. Just because I'm curious.
Maybe,
are you,
yes,
saying that there's no rule there? Are you, that is not?
I'm saying that, let me articulate two differences. One is that clearly there's an intention here, intention of taking advantage or of deceiving, okay? And that was not the case in Ona in the first place.
Right.
All right? There was no case of that. One difference. The second difference is that there is redress. There is a way of redressing the situation in the economic hona'a. What do you do in this case? What do you do in this case?
I see the store owner has no cause of action.
Right, right. There's nothing you can do about it. There's really nothing you can do about it. If there's nothing you can do about it, then we're in the realm of propriety, of proper behavior. Of proper behavior. Because there's no ultimate punishment for it. Okay? In the former area, there was a way of achieving equity. We could return this much money or that much money, we could cancel a transaction, we could do something like that. In the interpersonal here, it's very different.
Let's say you had a nudnik. He's well known in the town. He goes and wastes all the shop owners. There'd be no bait in for all the shop owners to take him to and say, this guy is a big nudnik.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure. Probably the way you deal with those nudniks is to throw them out. I mean, there are ways to deal with them. But I'm not sure that the Bet Din would deal with them. Probably the store owners, you learn who the person was and you kick them out.
I have a question in terms of the nature of halakha. Does halakha have to be biblically based?
Does halakha have to be biblical based? I don't know the answer to that, except that halakha usually is biblically based. Whether it has to be...
Was that part of the definition of halakha?
No, I wouldn't define halakha that way at all. I would, in a much more simple way, define halakha as law. Right? Halakha is law. So what is Haggadah? Everything else. You know? Because the way that's normally, it's translated either as legend, well, certainly not legend, this is not legend. Lore, L-O-R-E, I don't have any idea what lore means. I simply don't know what it means in English. So although it's a common way of translating Haggadah, I honestly don't know what it means. So my way of doing it is halakha is law, and Haggadah is everything else. Okay? Here I think I kind of know the parameters that I'm dealing with a little bit, because I think I'm dealing with ethics. And I know the way people have ethical discussions, and they're different from legal discussions. If you read Aristotle, for example, the Nicomachean Ethics of Aristotle doesn't read like halakha. It simply doesn't. Aristotle doesn't talk about it that way. Okay? Right and wrong has a lot to do with what in Aristotle, for example, what is conventional. And it has a lot to do with what is virtuous. Virtuous. Okay? Well, that's very hard to quantify. Very hard to quantify. Which makes ethics really somewhat unique. And that's why ethics is its own branch of philosophy. You can't really deal with it the way everything else does. What's unique about Judaism also is that you have a halakha. You might say, as, for example, in Christianity, where you have only one law, at least in the Protestant version, or a lot of the Protestant versions, which is that there is a law of love, and you have to do whatever love commands. So I had a professor once, Professor Paul Ramsey, who was professor of ethics at Princeton. Ramsey wrote a whole book on attacking Protestantism. He said, to say that love, what love commands is obvious is ridiculous. What you have to end up doing is creating laws. Well, that just illustrated to me the inherent difficulty of the whole thing. When you're dealing with ethics, sometimes you can move to quantification, you can move to rules, you can have a rule-based ethics. That's what Ramsey was trying to create at Princeton. But sometimes you can't have a rule-based ethics. There are other types of ethics where you're basing yourself on knowing what to do, on being virtuous, on being kind. That's also ethics. That's also ethics, okay? So they're not exactly the same thing. Halakha is where you can base it in rules. Agadah is where, in fact, in most cases, you're not going to be basing it in rules. Even though this is sort of a rule. But you'll see it's going to start wandering all over the place, too. Yes?
Okay. The commandment is we should all be ethical in our business, I guess, and in our personal life. We all try to be. I get the rabbis have tried in the microcosms and individual moments try to define what is and what is not within reason, within a sixth, within 100% plus or minus the what is reasonable and what right. Today lawyers do that and that. And the question is really what is right in terms of ethical in personal relations and what is right ethical in a, and that's really it's left up to. So I guess at the in my life I had a life defining moment where I was in a business deal that was very big and the people that I was dealing with were doing things that were clearly illegal. And in order to do the deal, I had to either comply with their illegality or pass on something which was inappropriate to pass on. I went to my lawyer, who was my life-defining moment, and I said to him, I laid out the situation, I said, what should I do? And he says to me, the first thing is it right what you're, is it right to do it? And my obvious answer was, clearly no, you know, it's not right. So then he says to me, well, what do you want me to do? You want me to tell you it's okay to do something that you know is not right to do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah.
So he, and that was the answer. And then we proceeded to find a legal way to do what was to achieve the end of the business deal, and it was done. But the answer is within yourself, and that's the hard thing to legislate.
Yeah, exactly. That's where we're going with this.
Yeah.
That's where we're going with this. Professor Max Kadushin wrote several books on the psychology of rabbinics. He's pretty, I think, today forgotten. Nobody except Kadushin's students remember who he was. And Kadushin tried to use sociological concepts that had been developed in the 20th century by people like Talcott Parsons and to create a vocabulary which to some extent could give us language to talk about these kinds of distinctions. He said, for example, that in Judaism there is behind what goes on in the Talmud what he called a value concept. Value concept. A value concept is something like justice. Justice is a value concept. Okay? Tell me what's just. Well, that's much more difficult. That's much more difficult. And value concepts like justice break down in a religious tradition like ours into halakha and agada. those areas where justice, in fact, can be articulated in rules, we will find it in rules. And yet there are other areas where it's much more difficult to do. And there, more frequently than rules, we will find it in stories. And frequently the way we know what to do is not by the abstract idea, but by listening to the stories of other people who have been through it. The way in which sometimes they weigh issues, but sometimes it's not that. It's just hearing how it's dealt with. It's just living through someone else's experience that in a way gives us the empathy to be able to see justice in action. Sometimes you need to be mentored. Parents do that with children. If you always say to your children the reasons why, and the assumption is that that is how you make them ethical children, there's some value to that. But you as parents know also that the most important thing you can do for your children is to provide them an example of how to live. And that's frankly not the same thing. What the Agadah does is provide examples of how to live, as opposed to the framework of rules by which one lives. Frankly, both of them need to be a part of the picture, but they're simply not the same thing.
The magnificence of the Torah, because it's both laws and stories.
Mm-hmm.
Stories that have morals to them. Sometimes the morals are pretty straightforward, sometimes the morals aren't. But it gives you both mechanisms by which to judge your life.
Mm-hmm.
It gets very, very different, because some are totally prescriptive. Others are obviously need to be interpreted, but you get some of each. In Hinduism, I mean, it is in fact, it is the stories of Rama that define all of their ethical behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the rock bed, are the stories.
I would even go, take that a little bit, a step further. Because we tend to think as Westerners that we need to abstract the ideas from the stories. And yet in those cultures that tell the stories, they don't spend that much time abstracting the ideas. They spend their time telling the stories. It is the act of being involved in the unfolding of the story that in a way is the source of knowledge about what is the right way to live.
And we start with the stories.
We do. Correct. But we start with the stories. Exactly. The book of Genesis is stories. Exodus, the first half of the book of Exodus, is also stories. Okay? And you abstract principles. Now, you'll see when we get into the discussions here, some of the things that you will see in the argument, you'll read this and you'll say, this is a terrible idea. How could anybody have said that? All right? Well, that's what's going to happen. Sometimes you'll see things like that. And the reality is that that's exactly what's supposed to happen. What reading a story does is not something that happens in the abstract. It happens in the construct of the thoughtful person who reads and responds, and therefore then continues the story. We continue the story when we may agree or disagree with the story. Doesn't make any difference. But it requires the presence and the continuation of the story of which we're an intimate part. That's the Agadah as it functions.
In terms of ethics and the looseness in trying to define ethical conduct or ethical rules, there are attempts by professional organizations, physicians, attorneys, CPAs, whatever, who have codes of ethics that really do spell out right as laws, and I think the only distinction really is rather than the laws being enforced before the law, it would be by some medical association or bar association. So I think there we do have examples.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Some of this, in any society, will manifest itself in rules. We need those rules. And in this one, too. I'm just expanding it beyond that. It's partly rules and partly something beyond
that. Right, but I guess what I'm saying is that it's really not the ethical codes of ethics. They're really not law. They're just developed from ethics, from rules of conduct, rules of behavior. I mean, it'd be more when you say that, you know, you have these rules of law, the Haggadah, and then you have everything else. It seems like you have something quasi in here.
Mm-hmm. You probably do. There's probably something in between. Probably true. Let's go on with the text now. Let's look a little bit further. Okay, we can now go into the Gemara. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. Tanu Rabbanan is a baraita. Lo tunu ish et amitaho ba'ona advarim ha'katuv medaber. We have, until this point in this chapter, been referring all the time to the biblical verse which says, you shall not wrong one person, his fellow. All right, where was that? That was over here. This is verse 17 of chapter 25. Lo tonu ishet amito, you shall not wrong. Tonu is hona'ah, is hona'ah. A person, his fellow, viareta melokecha. Oh, wait, I'm not sure that. No, I'm sorry. No. Wait. It's Vayikra Kafei, but I skipped ahead. It's verse 14. It's 25:14. V'chitim karu nimkar la'amitecha. When you sell something of a sale to your fellow. Or you make a purchase from your fellow's hand. And remember, the language was very crucial in the development of the law here. Al tanu ish et achiv. You shall not wrong a person, his brother. Okay? So that's the first thing that's quoted here now. So, lo tanu ish et amitahu. You shall not wrong one another. Ba'onat avarim ha'katuv medaber. This is the second case. Further on in verse 17, Leviticus 25, verse 17, it says, Lo tonu ish et amito. The second verse. It's not the one we've been studying.
Right.
The second verse. You shall not wrong a person, his fellow. And it then goes on, it says nothing about transactions.
Not from his hand.
Okay? Nothing about a hand.
Right.
It says simply, you shall fear your God, I am the Lord your God. That's all it says. So that verse, Tanu Rabban Lo Tanu Ishatamitecha, the second verse, Ba'ona Advarim HaKatuv Medaber. This is referring to wronging someone with words. Because the other one talked about mimkar, about sales. So this is another verse, so it couldn't be talking about the same thing. This is the parsimony of verses in rabbinic thinking. If there are two verses which seem to say the same thing, they can't possibly be saying the same thing. They must be adding something. So one of them talked about sales, the other one just seems to be general. Ah, that is the source. That is the biblical source now of our notion that you're not allowed to wrong somebody with words. Atal mer ba'ona advarim. Do you say now that verse deals with words that wrong somebody? O eino ella ba'ona atmamon. How do you know? Maybe it's talking about wronging somebody with their money. Maybe that. Well, kishu omer vechitim karu minkar. When the Torah comes and says, when you make a sale, you shall not wrong anybody, that one refers to wronging somebody with money. When we have the other verse and it just says that you shall not wrong anybody, that is clearly referring to something else, which we understand to be referring to harming someone with words.
So why wouldn't they just say, with
or not Dvarim in the
Torah?
In the Torah, if that's
I can't tell you.
What?
I don't know.
Because they're so specific in the first instance, why shouldn't they be so specific in the second instance?
No, who knows?
I'll tell you, Isha Tamito, why do you need the first verse? Because the first is a subset, because you're also harming a person with words in sales.
Oh, it's really different. It's not just words. Not just words. You're actually taking the money.
Means of words.
Okay. You might not know the meaning.
Yeah.
You said in the first, when we discussed earlier session, when we discussed Ona'ah, it's some kind of a fraud, but with no intention. Ona'ah Dvarim constitutes intention.
Exactly. Correct. So you see that what a distinction that we had made earlier, in fact, no longer applies here. In fact, these examples that we've been given in the Mishnah are examples where intention seems to be crucial. And you'll see how crucial it is, even more so, in what's going to come up now in the Gemara.
I still think that when it comes to a serious buyer and seller, meaning somebody who seriously wants to buy or to sell and not go shopping, the question of opinion is the crucial element, because it depends how much the item is worth to one or the other. If it is too high, the buyer will not buy it. And if it's too low, the seller will lose money or will lose the value of it in his business, and therefore he will not sell it.
But what we learned before was Ona'ah in general is, what if one or the other has insufficient knowledge of an appropriate market price? We are then giving them recourse in that circumstance. And that is what the Torah is allowing us to do, or is telling us that we have to do.
But then one says that ignorance is bliss.
Well, it does allow for a certain amount of ignorance for a certain amount of time. Okay? Because people sometimes are at a disadvantage, and that's just the nature of life. We don't allow it forever. There are limits, there are time limits on it, but we do take it into consideration. Why? As was said several times, this is to protect people. It is to protect people, and that is a better way to live than to cut people's throats. Okay? It's a better way to live. There's another hand. Mark, did you have your hand?
No, just one.
You're just traveling.
It seems to me that maybe it'll become clearer about the intention. It seems to me that some of these things that we're talking about are thoughtless, not intentionally wrong.
Hold on with that. We'll get to it. Okay?
Can I just ask one?
Yes, sir.
Just to go back a little bit, really following up on Mark's question. Do you think the rabbis thought that they were trying to figure out a divine basis for law and ethics, that in a sense they thought they were the same source of authority, or that they said, okay, the halakha is divine, this is a commandment, and the ethics is what we're doing. We're like the U.S. Congress, we're trying to figure out a good way to live, but this is not divine. It's different.
My own sense is that both are divine. That they assume both were divine.
Right. That's
both were divine.
Okay. I think today, but when people talk about Agadah today, I think they don't.
They diminish it. I think they diminish the significance of Agadah. It's as if, and the point is well taken. In the world, let's say, of Orthodoxy, Halakha has a certain sanctity to it. Agadah, it's Agadah. No, it's not important. It's insignificant. I think that's completely wrong. It's completely wrong. In fact, you will see that interpretation of the text frequently is self-serving if you do that. Sometimes people will take certain things in the Agadah and take it very seriously, and there'll be no standards for it whatsoever. But that's the chaos and some of the mistakes. Keep that in mind. If any of you read the English commentary on the bottom, you will see in the next few pages some awful commentary. Usually I like this commentary. This commentary is a wonderful commentary. Some of the stuff that's coming up here is horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And it shows the pitfalls of the Art Scroll view of the world, which, I'll, when we get to it, I'll show you some of the examples of what one shouldn't do when reading a Talmudic text, which is classically done by many who read it. Hakeitzan, what are we talking about? Give us an example. Imaya Baal Tshuva. If someone was a penitent, Al Yomarlo, one should not say to him, Zachor Ma'asecha Rishonim. Remember your first deeds, what you used to be like in the old days. Imeya ben Gerim. So this is repeating much of what we read in the Mishnah. If a person was descended from proselytes, from converts, Al Yomarlo Zachor Ma'asecha Avotecha. Don't say to him, remember what your ancestors used to do. Imaya ger uval yilmod Torah. This is adding something that's not in the Mishnah. If he was a ger, if someone was a proselyte, and he came to study Torah, al yomarlo, one shouldn't say to him, pesha achal nevelot utrefot, shkatzim urimasim, bal yilmod Torah. A mouth like yours that's eaten tarfis, that's eaten shkatzim, you know, that's eaten insects and all kinds of forbidden things, that mouth should also study the Torah.
That's the purpose of the Torah, to teach them.
So, now, this is what I'm telling you. This is the nature of the way you teach ethics. Frequently you teach ethics, and you know this when you teach children, by overstating a case. And you'll see that one of the things we're going to see is an overstatement frequently of what the case should be. This is a good example of it. But here, look at the next one. Imayu yisurim ba'imalav. If a person had experienced a great deal of suffering, imayu chala'im ba'imalav. If he had experienced a great deal of sickness, Osha hayam mekaber et banav, or God forbid, he had buried his children. Right? People had a lot of trouble in life. Right? And what if a person goes through these things? Al yomar lo kederech she'amru lo chaverav le'ihov. A person should never say to that person who has experienced such suffering what the friends of Job said to him. Halo yiratcha kislat techa tikvatcha v'tom derachecha zachorna mihu naki avad. Could not you fear Hashem? Could not your fear of Hashem have given you your confidence, your hope, the integrity of your ways? In other words, if you were really a religious person, these things wouldn't have happened to you. So it must be because you had sinned that you are suffering. Fantastic. Here, the Gemara says, you never should say anything like that. Never, ever say anything like that to somebody who is suffering. Right? Because the Torah says, Lo tonu, you shall not wrong one another, be devarim with words.
Now I know even less about what that verb means. It's so broad now.
It's expanding. It's expanding enormously to show us a variety of circumstances, some of which are really religious. Religious, where you're saying to somebody, don't you, you know, your ancestors, they ate tarfus, all this kind of, or you think that you could really be a religious person, look where you came from, look what you've been doing, you know? Or this idea of suffering, the simplistic idea that people must suffer because they deserve what they get. People get what they deserve. The Gemara obviously rejects that.
So, of all the ways that somebody can wrong another person verbally, these seem to have something in common, which relates to the first example about the shopkeeper, perhaps, the footnote for the shopkeeper actually says that the problem isn't that you're wasting the shopkeeper's time, but that by asking the price and walking away, you might lead him to mistakenly lower his price and, in a sense, undervalue what he owns. And the next two examples also have this feature that perhaps what you do, the way you're wronging the person, is you might lead them to undervalue themselves. You're reminding the penitent of their mm-hmm. bad deeds, or you're reminding the proselyte of their former ways. You're leading them to undervalue themselves. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think if you take the first, the way you said it, it makes good sense. It's nice what you said. Starting with the note of the art scroll, I don't like that comment of art scroll. Yeah. You could probably suspect that. I wouldn't go there. But if you start there, I like where you went from there, because you sort of redeemed them.
And it connects the notion of economic value that we were discussing before with this way of wronging.
I like that. I like that. I think it's well said. It's very well said. Yes?
The rabbi says to us, if we don't do this, and this, we will be punished by God, by no rain, or certain things will happen to us. And here you say that we cannot even say to other people, even though the Torah specifically say to us, don't do this, and this, because this and this will happen.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
No, but I mean, I'm allowed to copycat the Torah.
No, you can't say it for somebody else. You might think it about yourself, but you can't tell anybody else that.
So it could be true, but I shouldn't mention it.
Right. Well,
correct.
It doesn't say it's untrue. Yes,
exactly. It doesn't say it's not true. Could be true. But you're not allowed to say it.
That's very different.
So why is Torah writing it?
Why is he not saying it? I just gave you the word out. Take it.
I was going to say that it's disturbing to me because by making this example, they're really voicing what people are thinking. And they're saying you shouldn't say it, but it's obvious that this is a thought process that comes, is that if you ate tripe, you can't do this. If you have suffering and sorrow, it's probably because, or maybe because you did something. And that's a very disquieting thing, that there is that supposition that is the extension of punishment for things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that they say this and then say don't say it, it's good that they say don't say it, but really gives voice to what people are thinking.
It's true. All you have to do is read the Bible. The Bible says both of those things. In truth, that's why we have the book of Job in the Bible. Job is, you know, just one of the most profound books of the Bible. It sort of sets the limits on, I think, on simplistic religion. Where, on the other hand, a lot of religion comes across that way. So you need to achieve in religion a balance between these extremes. And it's very, very important to have the breaks on the otherwise simplistic approach to right and wrong and the way one lives.
Let's say those ideas aren't common, supposing, I think it gives people a comfort to know that other people think the same way, and then if there is what we know from psychology and teaching, you're giving voice to it, so then you can internalize what you should and shouldn't say. But if you don't give voice to it, then you think yourself that you're the outlier and there's something amiss within you for thinking that way. So you could give the rabbis credit for acknowledging mm-hmm. this fact of us, but then therefore say we don't need to dwell on it publicly.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Correct.
Yep. It's a question really of how do you instill ethical behavior?
Mm-hmm.
Really, you can't legislate it. You can't, you know, command it. It really has to be instilled within each of us. And how is that achieved?
And that's from the parents.
Well, my sense here is that the way it's done in the Talmud is by reading the story. It's by participating in this kind of a discussion. The discussion that we are having here is the way in which it works. That's the way the system functions. Okay, let's go a little bit further and get to the end of that. Imayu chamarim mevakshim tvuah mimena. if donkey drivers were looking for grain from someone, their job is they're truck drivers, right? And they need to find somebody who has grain that they can transport. That's how they make a living. Lo yomar lehem luchu etzel ploni shehu mocher tvoa. You should not say to them, go over to that person, he's selling grain. V'yodea bo shalom achar me'olam. While you know that that person has never sold grain before. Right? You're simply, now it's not exactly clear what your motivation is. Either your motivation is just to be a pain in the neck, or to act as if you know something, or to be a detriment to this man's business. There are a whole wide variety of possibilities here, but in fact, you simply shouldn't say something that you know is not true. All right? You for whatever the reason is, whatever the motivation is, there could be, as I say, a variety of possible motivations here, you shouldn't do it because you know that this person has not engaged in that kind of trade before. Okay? Yodei shalom achame olam. Rabbi Yehuda omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Af lo yitle enav al metach b'sha'a she'en lo damim. A person should not even literally hang his eye on merchandise when he does not have the money to buy it. In other words, this is an anti-consumer type of thing. This is the consumer type of mentality. You shouldn't be looking at and therefore conveying to the seller that you might be interested in it, when in fact you don't have the money to buy it, and you're not therefore interested in it. The only way you could really be interested in it is if you have the money for it. Okay?
Is that though for the purchaser, or is that for the seller? Because it could be that you shouldn't be spending your time longing for this thing, because it might lead you into something else if you don't have the wherewithal to get it.
I'm reading it as if this is protection for the seller.
We already had one protection
for the seller. Yeah, well, you're reading Talmud. You're saying, well, maybe one is for one thing, the other is for something else. I don't know the answer to that. You may be right. Okay. Any questions, Tony? Very good. We'll pick up from this point next time.
Rabbi, you made reference to yoga.
Yes.
Did they ever follow the laws of yoga?
When I found this test,
I'm
now very upfront.